I'd like to welcome everybody today. This is the last presentation of this grant project. I'd like to thank you all for attending dedicatedly, devotedly. Some of you have attended all the lectures in April and May. Some of you have attended some of them. Some of you, this is your first time. It's fantastic to see you here. We've had a great turnout. I want to just let you know again, like I always do, this is funded by the LEF Foundation of San Rafael, California, by San Francisco. The grant came to the Old Spanish Trail Association. These lectures are occurring here for 2 months consecutively. As a lead up to the first weekend of June, there will be a national conference of the Old Spanish Trail Association at the Skyute Resort, Ignacio, Colorado, on the Southern Ute Indian Reservation. So these are lead up activities, and they're excellent. All the presenters are from Northern New Mexico, cultural diverse. Some of the research is scholarly, academic, like Jose Rivera, PhD from UNM. Others are local, amateur type researchers like me. I even have a manuscript ready to publish, and the title of my manuscript of my research is Camino Real North, Stories About the Real North. Anyway, that'll be printed soon. I want to give a sincere thanks to a number of people that are here today, like Mark Henderson. I thank you, sir. Mark has been my guardian angel. Then he says my little guardian devil, but anyway, that's kind of like a inside joke. Anyway, I thank Mark Henderson. I thank Warren Kelly. I thank Chris Edwards and the Schraders and the Burrs and Gerald Quintana and Whitney Golaire, Mr. Pierre, Mr. Balsam, the Nesbitts, Tom Adams, all of you that are here that have been coming. And it's really wonderful. This is really cool. In particular, I want to give thanks to the library to provide this space to hold these lectures. The library, last July, the director and I met, and we talked about maybe holding a speaker series here. So he said, identify 5 speakers. We'll be able to get a small gift from the Friends of Taos Library to pay these speakers $100 each. So I did that. And then I contacted Donald Davidson, who I really thank for searching for a grant, and he's the one that is credited with obtaining this grant for us. A small grant, like $5,000, but it was enough to be able to do what we're doing. So I thank Donald Davidson, who was the manager of the Old Spanish Trail Association, and Mark Henderson and his wife, Yolanda. And I also want to give credit and recognition, okay, like I said, the Taos Library, the Friends of Taos Public Library, as well as the Taos News, which has done a tremendous job with the advertisements, and KTAO, Cultural Energy, who is conducting all these audio tapes here, all the taping, KXMT, advertisements in Spanish and English, KFUN Las Vegas, New Mexico, who also did an interview of me recently. I'd like to thank as well Southside Copies, who provided a generous discount to us to print 600 of those art prints that were distributed throughout Northern New Mexico and Durango. I'd like to recognize and thank all the speakers. We had 10 speakers. And I'd like to congratulate all you all that joined the organization. Last October, when I approached Ron Reinekine, and he works at the library, about joining, he joined right away. So that was 2 of us. And then later on, Mr. Henderson and his wife moved here from Las Vegas, Nevada, and they were already members. So that's 4 of us. So ever since this lecture series has been happening, we have gained about 20 new members. I salute you all, and I thank you. I also at this time would like to give recognition to my partner, Peter McInnes, here with the sombrero. He and I, from year 2000 to 2005, were involved in attending workshops, conferences, lectures concerning El Camino Real. the federal initiative. We went to meetings on our own time, voluntarily, through the grace of God, the Creator, sending us out there to collect information at Española, Santa Fe, Albuquerque, Socorro, Las Cruces. And so we did a lot of work, and he's very, very knowledgeable concerning El Camino Real, the old Spanish trail, El Camino Militar, the Kit Carson Trail, the Kiowa Trail. So there he is. Gracias.
Thank you.
Okay, so this grant project ends today. I encourage you all to join the Old Spanish Trail Association. It's only $25 membership per year. I encourage you also to attend the Old Spanish Trail National Conference that will occur the first weekend in June at Ignacio, Colorado at the Skyute Resort. Here's the outline. When you join the organization, you receive a quarterly magazine called Spanish Traces. And there, here on the second page, there's mention of this lecture series occurring here. The Interpretation Education Committee, the LIVF Foundation, funded the current April-May 9-week lecture series at Taos Public Library. So now people know that there's a Taos Public Library. Today we have a final presenter, and I really am very appreciative that I met him when he and I were members of the TAO, Taos Art Organization, which is a new art organization in Taos. It's for all artists, whether you're professional, you're amateur, you're beginning, it's for everybody, of all the cultures. Okay, I present now Warren Kelly, and Luella is his wife. She'll be later.
Luella begin. Later. And my father-in-law just walked in, so now I'm nervous.
Okay.
So, hopefully all of this technology will work because I happen to be a technophobe. I'm trying to stay behind the microphone, for example, and everything else. My name is Warren Kelly. I teach at Taos Charter School, grades 5-8. I manage the bilingual program, but at our school anyway, it basically ends up being that I'm a Spanish teacher. So I'm the Gabacho con ganas, which is pretty much, you know, the way it goes around here. My family has been in New Mexico for quite a while, so I feel at home here, even though I don't look very much at home sometimes. And people are still surprised. You're like, yeah, that kid actually knows his stuff. So I hope I do this justice. I met with Lloyd about this at the beginning of, not even the beginning of the school year, and we just got some things together about how to start to teach about the Spanish Trail. And if you don't have a packet in front of you, find somebody who does and like look over their shoulder. I had 25 copies, and I thought I had too many, and now I have too few. So if you could just let somebody look over. I'd like to start by saying that, you know, after finishing this project, I really did have some deep thoughts, which is scary for a middle school teacher. And this is kind of the summary of my deep thoughts, is on that first page. I'll read this to you. I won't read anything else to you. One of the most relevant factors of the trail from the perspective of public, that is civic education, is the deep multicultural interface the trail represents. This is a new trail from the sense that nobody knew anything about it. It was a new idea. It was recognized in 2002. And so for a child who's seen, and I don't mean anything by this, but anything from the Boston Tea Party to Rosa Parks to any of these other stories, sometimes a story has a certain lifetime and it becomes old and needs to be renewed. And here is an actual new story that doesn't need any renewing because it's brand new. And so what the kids learn about this trail is something they can bring home and say, look what I learned. Yeah.
Could you step off a little?
Yeah.
One of the sites?
Well, you don't need to see that
oh,
yet.
Okay.
Anyway, as history is revisited and revised, and as new stories are selected to tell our children, which fit our visions for the future and the reality of the present, I believe that the Old Spanish Trail is an authentic story, not a superficial one, as many educational attempts at civic education and multiculturalism often are. And why is this? Because there are, again, authentically human subplots to tell about the Mexican-American, the Anglo, and the Native, and also the French and other, you know, the Native peoples, obviously, there's many nations. So I say more there, and which take place in a short period of history. We're talking about this trail as being recognized over the period of history of 30 years. And so this isn't a huge story that a fifth grader is going to go, oh my goodness, I can't get this. This is too much. So this is a compact story. And it has lots of compelling characters to depict, which represent living American cultures and languages, and which take place in landscapes which have had
or made a huge contribution in forming the American psyche. I'm thinking maybe of a picture some of you know by Thomas Moran of the great Rocky Mountains that hangs in the Smithsonian. These landscapes that we live in were what people thought of as America, even though they had never visited. And so this trail runs through our imaginations as Americans. And I mean Americans in the sense of both continents, I think, as well as United States citizens. So the Spanish Trail is worthy of knowing in a sense that is that a Emerson or a Dewey, which are American philosophers, or a Vasconcelos or a De Loria, which is a Latin American and a Native American philosopher, respectively, would recognize and applaud. And I really believe this. I think that there's a lot to this trail that could be used in the future, and I hope that this is just the beginning, not just for me, but that perhaps it will be used in other places and curricula and stuff like that in the future. So, just to tell you what I'm going to do now, I'm going to show you a slideshow of what my kids did. I teach one class of fifth grade. I'm going to show what our speakers that came to the fifth grade did with them, namely Lloyd and Mark. We also had Jerry Padilla come, but unfortunately, I didn't get any video or any images from Mr. Padilla's presentation, and I'm sorry for that. So we'll concentrate on what I do have. And then I want to talk a little bit about something else in this packet, if I have time. We may not get to it, which basically breaks down to what I'm talking about here, which is the story of the trail, the drama of the trail, as a story you would tell a kid. And then the second part is more of a linguistic, something more in line with what I'm supposed to be doing as a Spanish teacher, as a bilingual educator, which is these languages that were tied to the trail aren't just Spanish and English and Tewa, Tiwa, Keres, but they're the interrelationship of the three, four, five languages actually produce results that you can see in the language. And Larry Torres has done a lot of this in his college classes. I'm trying to do a little bit here at the charter school. And then I'll refer to this book right now, Aurelio Espinosa, who's a northern New Mexican who did a lot of field work in the early 20th century. This book is a hugely interesting resource to pick up, and I'm sure there's a copy in the library. This is my copy. And I'll talk about some of the other book here in just a moment. So let's start off with the slideshow. First, we start off with the trail, and there's that guy, Mark Henderson. And he came to speak with us first. And there he is yelling at my students. But he seems to have their attention except for Kobe, who's looking in the long distance there. So actually, Lloyd did a very good job getting people excited about this. He brought in a lot of maps. We did a little bit of brainstorming about what a trail was, because it's not entirely clear what a trail is. You know, how does a trail formed? How does it begin? And so, you know, you can see a little bit of the notes that we took up there, a little bit of bilingualism there. My fifth graders, by the way, are not master Spanish students, so a lot of the stuff happened mostly in English. And so there's Mateo and Kobe, and then when Kobe figures out that I'm taking a picture, he gives me the I'm cool look. You'll see that look again. But here you're seeing them look at the National Trail System and taking a look in particular about where the old Spanish trail runs, and they're just exploring. But then what Mark tried to do with a series of GPS maps, or not GPS, yeah, I guess they're kind of GPS, they're satellite maps. I use different ones here for the purposes of this discussion was, how do you identify a trail? So here we have an image from, if I can read the elevation there. We're 8,400 feet in the air over whatever the basic land elevation above us. And this is the Picari Mountains. So you have Ranchos de Taos in the north, Peñasco in the south, and that little blue dot there, if you can see it, I believe is U.S. Hill as kind of a place of interest. All right, so you can see some formations here. You can see U.S. 68, which is way up here, and you can see 518, which is here. You obviously can see the town and the green belt, and just take a note of what the scale is right now, because we're going to zoom in. Oops, I got to go back. Ooh. No, I got it. So here is the same, is the same image blown up a little bit more. And you can still see 518 off to the right-hand side. And you can see Picaris Peak on the left. And also that blue dot, which is U.S. Hill. Also take note of the landmarks. You can see the trail. You can see the trail of 518 in this case. Think of the scale. Think of the width of the line, because here's the last one. Now we've zoomed in so that you can see individual trees. This is somewhere near the saddle of Miranda Canyon.
You have, if you can see really closely, two tracks. One is almost just an opening in the trees now, and the other one is more visible in the lower right. But the other one shows up right there. And these might actually be just ATV trails.
The whole idea is that there's an immensity of scale into a very intimate scale, and to get the idea that, you know, when the trail was formed and people were walking with it, that's all they had. There was no landmark like 518. If I get lost and I keep walking to the west, I'm going to hit a highway, was not a reality. And so this is something that's important for them to grasp, is that you're in the middle of an immense landscape. And the imagination that gives to them of being in the middle of something where your only path is just a little light green and a little bit more dark green is something that was important. So anyway, there's Miss Woodall, who was the fifth grade teacher. She was very gracious in letting us take over her classroom. And, there's this guy. So Lloyd came in, and he came in with
lots of handouts. So he brought in posters with bilingual vocabularies. And these vocabularies are not necessarily textbook Spanish. In other words, there may be the possibility that there are inner relationships between Ute language and the cultural language. I'll take your question in 1 second. But we're really not sure. That's what we were telling the kids, is some of this inner relationship of language, you know, is a quilta really? You know, that must be, you know, from the Hiberian cultures way up there in Scotland. I've never used cinta as a belt except for around here in northern New Mexico. And these are things that some of the kids have already heard through their parents and grandparents, and so they recognize this. I think Lloyd has written a map and everything he's given me, so he has about 5 or 6 maps that he made for the kids. He also brought together, you know, different pictures to try to show them the experience of the trail. And since there's really no literature about the trail yet, he had to collage. And so you'll see that kids are very comfortable with this. Pick whatever works. So he's got pictures from different trail guides, because the old Spanish trail guide really hasn't been formulated yet. And that's exciting for the kids. So here's some more maps. Lloyd went down into even hypothesizing where the trail might have run through our own town of Taos area. And so the kids were asking things like, did it go by my house? Did it go by my house? Did it go by my house? Did it go by my house?
They asked Mr. Henderson that too, because that's what they really wanted to know. All right, so he did a very good job presenting all of those materials, and we kind of, you know, made it an environmental experience. He brought in some books. Here comes another one of those looks. Uh-huh. Serious. Okay. Anyway, it was a good experience all around for everybody. Now to go back what I did with them, I'm interested in that kind of drama, that story that the trail can tell, and how to hang as many elements onto that story as possible. So here's the story that the kids wrote of the old Spanish trail. We sat down and wrote this together. I typed it up. But this is actually the second page you have here in your packet.
These images come from another book by
Ilan Stavins and Lalo Alcaraz. Alcaraz is he's a cartoonist from LA, and Ilan Stavins is a professor who was originally from Mexico. He teaches at Columbia now. And this is actually a book we use. It's a cartoon history of Latin America. I have a few copies up here if you all want to try to take a look at the end. This is the best textbook I've ever found for middle school class, because it's what they want to read. And also the sense of humor here, this is a very sarcastic, ironic, it's not even very respectful in places, this book. And it definitely has a point of view as a Latin American, Stavins, against the Yankee colonial capitalists. And so I says, you know, all history has a point of view. You just happen to be able to see this author's point of view. And now let's talk about yours. So it's not the kind of textbook that tries to hide a point of view. It's right up front. And that's what I asked the kids to do in their own book, is to show their point of view. So our idea was, you know, what is a trail? How did this trail come from Santa Fe or Abiquiú to what now they thought of as Los Angeles in a lot of ways? How did that happen? And what does it mean to be a New Mexican with a place that this area has in history? Also, we talked about great migrations. So this falls into all kinds of different stories that these kids learn about. the movement of peoples, and how that forms, you know, kind of an archetypal storyline in our society and in education in particular. And so, you know, and how was it built? You know, here's the future site of the Spanish Trail. Hope you can see the picture because Mateo's a great illustrator. And also, we talked a lot about the three basic cultural groups, but often, you know, there were many more different kinds of, you know, European trader. The Mexicans had their own cultural differences, and of course, the Native Americans did. But it broke down to three. And also, you know, the question was, where would you find the question, the trail today? What would be left behind? And we talked a little about what might survive, you know, 100 or so years of not being used, because the trail is now and has not been used for over 100 years. So what's left? Horseshoes, metal instruments, that kind of thing. So anyway, these are the kids that did this book, giving credit where credit is due to Mark and Lloyd and Kathleen, the fifth grade teacher, and then all these people you see here in their favorite handwriting. Here's another picture. That's me in the middle. And here's yet another picture. Mark Henderson is at the top. He's wearing some kind of a expedition hat like Indiana Jones. Lloyd has a top beaver skin hat, and I always get the crazy looking glasses. So in the beginning, the Ute, Navajo, Apache, and Pueblo people live, travel, and trade in the rugged country we call the American Southwest. Spanish, French, and English arrive in the 16th through 18th centuries. And what I like to see about these pictures is what kids do to interpret this information. You'll see inaccuracies. You'll see things that are wrong. But then you have to think, why is it wrong? Because it's not wrong to them. They're not actually making mistakes on purpose. And so you then get to think as a teacher, as an adult, why are these misperceptions here on the page? And sometimes they're more revealing than if they had gotten it right and just listened to me, right? Because the mistakes they make reveal something about them. So here we have the cultural groups. Oh, there's the Europeans. And, you know, and sometimes their experience was this. Oftentimes the Native Americans opened their arms to them. And again, it's interesting that often the Europeans are depicted in rags. For example, from my fifth grade class, and that goes to the story of Cabeza de Vaca, which was discussed last week, who walked a very long way across a very difficult passage and probably did wear rags by the time he got back to Mexico. And then we have the clash of languages. Here in this case, we have an hola and a hello. Oh God, here come the French and the English. And I guess that's a Frenchman or an Englishman there. You can tell by the mustache. But basically what brought the peoples together was they could exchange goods and ideas. And so trade was what brought these people together. And really, there was this period of time where the Spanish Trail was in use that it's kind of what we have in romanticized as a frontier experience where there were no rules and you could make it up as you went along. And so often, you know, we feel like those were the good old days when we didn't have everything put in place. We didn't know what all the outcomes were going to be. And I really think that from the point of view of history, this was one of those places where these cultural groups came together and had to figure it out on the fly. And I think that that's what makes it an enjoyable thing to think about developing for school. So let's trade. Yay! In November 1829, an expedition of 31 New Mexicans under Antonio Armijo assembled on the old Plaza Abiquiu, overlooking the Chama River. They hoped to exchange woven goods for mules and horses. And so these vocabulary words that Lloyd supplied kind of filled that out. And so one of my favorite illustrations, of course, they're getting ready to leave. And so we'll move on. That's the idea. Okay, colchas and mantas and sarapes for horses. But there was this problem. There was something in the middle. This unknown territory from New Mexico to California. And they knew about California because there were previous expeditions that went up through there. There was boats that went around, all the way around South America to go there. It was not an unknown place, California, but how to get there effectively was unknown. And so they give it a try. I often find that kids where their pictures are traveling to the left, they're traveling west. And they did that pretty consistently, and it's interesting. You'll notice that. Well, it makes sense, right? New Mexico became the frontier of the European settlements, communicating with the Spanish to the south and the English-speaking United States to the east. To the west was uncharted native territory. So you can just see this is fifth grade stuff here. What's gonna happen? And there's another depiction of the unknown center. Mexico to the south, New Mexico, and then the big piece in the middle before you get to California. It's hard for kids to unthink state boundaries, though, as you'll see. The state boundaries are there no matter what period of history they're talking about. I don't think that's necessarily a mistake. It's a way of framing their reference. Here's a better map, in my opinion, even though it's a clunkier drawing, because there it is. That's a big nothing. It's a big nothing. And so there's New Mexico, poor thing. And again, this is almost like a Basquiat painting. The traders, the risk takers, and the conquistadores. So if you're a fifth grade boy, you're into this. On the other hand, native territory is the middle of nowhere, as you can see. And then there are New Mexico, Santa Fe, and Albuquerque. So there's that cultural bias. And you point this out to kids. Is it middle of nowhere to whom and why? Hispanic New Mexicans were the first to blaze trails to California in the 1830s. Who would have thought that some of the first Californians came from New Mexico? This was a good idea for me. I had no idea. Apparently, many Californians don't know they're from New Mexico. So, yeah, people are pretty confused. I like this one. We have the Native American speaking in some kind of pictograph. And then Kit Carson over there is very confused. And the Mexican or the Spaniard is wearing an L.A. Dodgers cap. I like it. Let's be Californians. Orange County since 1830. And so there they go. Or you could see it this way. It's cute, huh? Now, this one's interesting because you have the boat going from the Gulf of Mexico around South America, and then you have this new trail. I beat you. So the New Mexicans got there first. They had a more effective means of transporting goods to at least Santa Fe. And so the idea of taking the wealth that you can keep if you don't spend it on transportation costs, here's the idea, right? I can get from here to there in a shorter amount of time, shorter distance, and keep more of my resources. It's an economic decision. And so the Californians, I'm from New Mexico. And there are quite a few groups, I think, around Barstow at the end of this trail that are interested in this section of the idea of the Spanish trail is, where am I from? Do my family bloodlines hark back to this area of the country here? Northern New Mexicans raised churros, a sheep from Spain raised primarily for its wool. From the wool, they crafted blankets in the tradition of the surrounding Pueblo, the Hopi, and the Navajo people. Navajos being also relative newcomers. And it looks like the sun is having trouble with the shearing there. But this, again, this harkens back to this kind of graphic style with the Latin American history from Alcaraz and Stavins. A good joke's going to make you remember something. And so here's the way it works. You have the churro, and then the naked churro, wool, the loom, and the wool blanket. And the Native Americans actually took the churro and made it their own. Beforehand, their blankets were made of cotton. So this was one thing that was, you know, culturally shared and benefits all. There's another sheep. I like the pictures of animals. I have lots of pictures of the different animals along the trail because it's interesting. This one loved cats but tried to do a sheep. I'm not quite sure what to do with that one. And that's actually quite a big, good drawing there with the loom. And there's the loom again. And so the loom technology actually was pretty basic and uniform throughout, you know, the cultures of the region. And it was probably one of the biggest contributions that the Spanish made to this area, along with bringing the wool as well. Some of these are actually very well thought out designs. You think, you know, drawing a rug, big deal. But these designs reflect what these kids saw in pictures. I think they're recognizable as designs. If you're an anthropologist or if you're a native weaver, you might say, I know what that's called. I couldn't tell you what this design is called, but I think it represents, you know, some real looking on the part of the students. They really wanted to get it right. Okay, so in 1830, California was almost completely uninhabited by Europeans and in need of small comforts like blankets and sarapes. California did have large herds of mules and horses, or at least horses. I'm not sure about the mules. And kids like to use graphs here. So the Europeans are very tiny. Mexicans are very large. Blankets, I don't know. They don't have many blankets in California, so that's very tiny. And they have lots of horses. See how that works? It's actually quite good. Again, there's the idea Armijo started off with. And the trade. Now, five blankets for a horse seems like a pretty high price for a horse, but that's actually quite a deal. blanket was very valuable. Here's two for one. And those blankets look confused. That's a blanket. And, you know, can you imagine the herds of mules coming from the trail westward and the herds of horses roaming around their initial contact? It's kind of funny. So it's not just cultural groups, not just human beings that are meeting one another. It's the herds and herds of horses. This is a horse. Those are horses. That's a cute horse. These horses and mules were valuable on another trail, the Santa Fe Trail. New Mexicans could trade Americans for factory goods, like, you're not going to trade the Americans, you're going to trade the horses with the Americans, for factory goods like iron tools, copper pots, rifles, and traps that came from the East. So now you got this intercontinental highway. Okay, the first Route 66, old Santa Fe to old Spanish Trail. Continent is crossed. And I think that's a pretty compelling idea there. Here's some more pictures about that. So the factories are in the east. The horses are in the west. Santa Fe's in the middle. Another depiction of that idea. Here's some stuff you can trade for. That's a horse. Some more. It's interesting. This pot looks a lot like some of my wife's work. And I didn't say anything. These ideas of what's out there are amazing. You'll recognize what's there. So hammers are important. So are guns. That's a plea for pots. Armijo rode to the San Juan River, then across northern Arizona, and after the Mojave Desert, reached the San Gabriel Mission outside of Los Angeles. The trip there, and Los Angeles wasn't there yet. The trip there had taken 120 days, but when he went home, it took him 40. So he learned a few things on the way. And it's interesting, you recognize that church there?
No.
Right. So it's not the San Gabriel Mission, but it's a good call for someone to draw. Because that is the culture that went there. All right, so there's Armijo going on his way. It's a very hard journey on the way. He doesn't know where he's going. He's gone too far south. It's too many canyons, not enough water. Finally makes it, here at last. Los Angeles. On the way home, he takes the direct route. And there he goes. Green pastures, the whole bit, right? He's got some stuff in his pack. So the original trail caused Armijo much trouble in the deep canyons of Arizona. The trail was altered to swing farther north through southern Colorado and Utah to avoid the canyons and deserts. And student has added he also had problems with the map. So the map's upside down. There was no map. Keegan is probably, you'll recognize his drawing as you get along. His name is Keegan Edwards. So anyway, here's some mistakes they made. Deserts, oops. Canyons, oops. Scorpions, wrong way. And so we got rivers and all kinds of things in between here in Los Angeles, here in San Miguel. What is this? Now what? Well, maybe this. Well, you know, you could lose your life on the trail. We can make it, yeah, like in 2 years, gurgle. I wouldn't want to be a mule. Oh, here's another mistake. So the mules actually were cinched up, and mules needed to be cinched up because these wagons were not able to pass on this trail. But on the other hand, you know, it's interesting. This is my feedback. I need to go into this area as a teacher and say, we need to get somebody in here with a mule, a cinch up a mule, and just show them. Because this is what they've seen in the country and Western movies and stuff like that. It's going to take a little bit more than me just saying so to break this picture down. So that's what I mean by catching mistakes. So the second and improved route goes to the north and follows river courses and is a little bit less canyon. And so that pretty much breaks it down pretty well. In general, you're avoiding those. You're avoiding Arizona. Let's just put it out. Okay, so dealing with the Indians along the route became very important for survival. The Ute knew the country best and acted as trail scouts. They offered deer skins in exchange for horses, bread, chile, and blankets. I'll let you pass if you give me some food. Deal. So here's another mistake. Do the Utes live in these structures? No, so there's another place to go. On the other hand, Abiquiú and Taos and other places where there were Pueblo societies were places where people met and traded all these different cultures. So it's not too far off the mark. There's a better picture of what's really going on the trail. And so if you go the wrong way and it's hot, you might want to get some advice. Don't go there. That way. Okay, good. And then you make, you know, seal the deal. You want to get some help on the way back too. So here's the interchange. Bread, chile, deer skins on the other side, and advice, blankets. Also, multicultural trading fairs occurred in Taos and Abiquiu. Native tribes and Europeans that fought most of the year traded for a short while. Having new horses to trade was in everyone's best interest. So trade was based on horses at this point. That's basically the currency of the time. Because that's what everyone wanted. You could keep that in common. There she is. All right. So this might be a place like Taos or a place like Abiquiu. Notice the cross, though. I don't think that's a mistake. So the Christianity on that side there. And here, you are definitely in Taos. You have the ceremonial pole. So this is St. Geronimo's Day, down there in the background. And that's exactly what we're talking about. The kids know a lot about this. They know this part very well. What will you trade? Well, maybe something like this. That looks like Mr. Peter's hat right there, right in the middle. And then, you know, because history is dominated by the history tellers, the feminine side of the story was something that you need to make room for. I think that this shows a real difference in feminine and male relations here. Two women are trading, and here are two men. I'll shoot you later, but I'll give you this horse for the blankets now. Fine, I'll kill you later too. The route from Santa Fe to California became known as the Old Spanish Trail. All transport was by long pack trains, since the way was too rough to accommodate wagons. And here the joke is that on the map, you've only traveled 2 inches. It's a good map, though. It's a good drawing. And here the map, I think, is probably talking mostly about the route being treacherous and mountainous. Here the map is talking about the many different routes you could choose depending on the season, depending on who you wanted to communicate with, who you wanted to avoid along the way. This one's more of a physical cultural map, so what can you buy on the way, what can you trade, and who lives where. So all those houses in the east and all open spaces in the west is an important thing. That's good information for a kid. And here's more of a linguistic map, cultural map. And here's one that brings it all together, and the mistake, of course, is the French horses are in California. I like that one. But the Grand Canyon's there, the deserts are there, represented by skulls and crossbones. The oasis is Las Vegas, Nevada. Mississippi River's there. The American pots and iron goods are out there in the colonies. Someone's running to Egypt, and there's no one in Alaska. And Alaska is in the map offset, where it should be. Here's more of a general kind of road map with the states already put in. Now, I tried to do some extra things with the trail after establishing the guidelines. And so up to here is kind of the trail story. And then I said, okay, where's the interesting points that we can go from? One of those little pieces of information that might get a kid interested to investigate further is this one, the Revolt of 1837, also known as the Revolt of Rio Arriba. That's us, folks. Forced New Mexicans loyal to Santa Ana, remember the Alamo, onto the Spanish Trail to avoid execution. Some New Mexicans chose to stay in California. So New Mexico had the same kind of disputes with both Mexico and the other Europeans, the Americans and everything else, as many other parts in the time, the Texans, for instance. And there was a time when New Mexico also wanted some independence from Mexico. They wanted some, maybe not a completely separate state, but they wanted to run the show up here because we're so far away from Mexico. And so the people who were loyal to Santa Ana were told to leave under pain of death, and they went to California, where it was safe. Nobody knew them. Went to the frontier. So they had to choose between life and death. And some of them didn't. Some of them did. There's the executioner, and there they go. And California was their new home. So in the 1837 rebellion, Julian Chavez and his family fled and settled in what a century later would become and called the Chavez Ravine inside the city of Los Angeles. His place was on the site where Dodger Stadium stands today. So that's something that can really grab a fifth grader right there. That these two stories are they are superimposed. And you're gonna have that one remembered. And so this is my house on second base. Get out of here. There's Julian, Julian, and his kids, and they settle in Dodger Stadium. Of course. Why is there a hut out in the field? Gee, I don't know, Tom. Get out of my yard. And the cow hits a homer. Another immigrant from New Mexico was Manuel Espinosa. So this is a story about the crypto-Jewish tradition, which I don't know a lot about, frankly. But the kids did read The Diary of Anne Frank this year in fifth grade. So this is on their minds. And so this is a place we went a little bit deeper than I thought we would. And Manuel Espinosa lived from 1821 to 1844. And he was descended from a family of Sephardic Jews, which before the 16th century used the original name of Spinoza. And some of you may know the philosopher Spinoza, the European important Enlightenment philosopher. So they're going to California through the mountains on the Spanish Trail. And maybe in a time like 1602, it was Manuel Espinosa, and a random person calls him Spinoza, because that's his original Jewish name. 1867, it's a little late actually, but you know, now they're calling him a Jew. So there's this latent sense of the issues that, you know, Diary of Anne Frank deal with are in development through this period of history too. That it just doesn't pop out in World War II like it nothing, didn't happen before. So there's this context that's being built here. And so the images of this Mr. Espinosa were more important than I thought. I got lots of responses from this, the comic version of Manuel Espinosa. After Spain expelled the Jews and Muslims in 1492, those remaining converted to Catholicism. Nevertheless, they remained under suspicion in New Mexico, even in New Mexico, and so many moved to California using the Spanish Trail. It's a fact that probably needs to be justified and documented more, but I think it's probably a truth, even on the small basis of evidence that I've gotten from places like the Spanish Trails, the magazine that Lloyd has shown you. So there they go, continuously on the move. Old Spanish Trail. It's a kind of an incongruous image here. You have two things you don't think go together, but they seem to go together here. And I think Mr. Sanders talked about that a little bit too, about these two traditions that we don't put together. But we should, because they did. It's fact. Gotta go. And I couldn't say it better myself. So in the 1830s, it was high fashion to wear a tall hat covered with beaver skin. Utes, Navajos, and Apaches trapped beaver in the Rocky Mountains with Europeans the like of Kit Carson during the beaver skin craze. Why was it a craze? Because the beaver didn't last long. And even the trappers knew that they were going to eliminate this resource relatively quickly. And so they went at it with a zeal. I like this one. ¿Puedo hablar con Kit Carson? I guess he doesn't want to talk to her. I believe he did speak Spanish. And Ute and many other languages. So there's one of those top hats. Oh, and there's an Anglo wearing his beaver skin hat. No, whose is better? And there's Kit Carson saying, mine's better, word. The whole idea of fashion and being up to date, you know, caught their interest too. That a beaver skin hat was like the baggy pants or whatever, you know, the big sneakers. On the other hand, for the beaver, it was something altogether different. It meant this. So there's a rifle, or this, there's a arrow, and a hatchet. American, French, and British traders trapped for beaver using the old Spanish Trail without Mexican permission. So this is the Mexican period of history. It's a short period of history, but you know, I think the Mexicans really did try to govern this area. They tried to hold on to it. They just couldn't make it work. And this was why, because there was too many resources of too much value at stake. So the trappers that were basically trespassing laid a foundation for the arrival of the 49ers. They knew the trails to get there. And also for the Mexican-American War, because the Mexicans and these other visitors weren't getting along, because basically, you know, if you weren't Mexican, you really didn't have permission to be there and take resources. So there's some ideas there. I think I skipped one. Nope. Is this really illegal? Sí, señor, it is. Don't shoot. Enough said there. Come on, little sucker, make me some cash. Get in. But then the upshot of all of this is that they weren't shooting at beaver after a while. They were shooting at each other. And although the conflict that gave America control over this territory didn't have too much bloodshed. There was some. There was some. And some of it occurred here in Taos. The Spanish Trail offered Indians, genízaros, mestizos, and poor people a chance to rise as high as their talent or good luck would take them. After the Mexican-American War, the trail was seldom used again. I should go back to that for a minute. This was kind of like your ticket up, the trail, in a way. You could take the trail, much like any frontiersman in Kentucky would take the old Santa Fe Trail. You found a new life on this kind of a trail. And so California was the West for the Mexicans, as much as for the people from Independence, Missouri. Okay, so there's the closure of the trail. It just passed into disuse, the trail did, pretty much. Closed. Oh, man! That's what he says. Good luck getting there, and use if you dare. Many women traveled this difficult trail, and in contrast to American women at the time, a new Mexican woman retained her property, her legal rights, wages, and her maiden name after marriage. This interested the little girls. So there's a graph, and there's one way of thinking of it. This is my property. She looks. Anybody say that what you own is your cage? Well, there you go. These are big ideas that the fifth graders are getting. And I think that, you know, the details, the devil's is in the details sometimes, but the big ideas are what's going to take them through and keep them interested. So, girl power. I traveled the trail and got two mules. By 1900, hundreds of Californians had parents who were natives of New Mexico. Funny, New Mexicans colonizing part of California and then later Californian hippies colonized northern New Mexico. Before, hey guys, let's live in California. Or, vámonos a California, probably. And then afterwards, let's go back to New Mexico. So that's how it works there. A little genealogy. And that's what she turned into. And this is very relevant for our summer of love. And finally, the U.S. Congress designated the Old Spanish Trail America's 15th National Historic Trail in 2002. The Old Spanish Trail was an important trail, and the people who made it shaped history. Okay, so, you know, the last images are kind of what we all tried to get. You know, it's a mode of transportation, it's a method of commerce, it's a cultural interchange, and the story hasn't ended yet. That's basically it. So that's that part of it. I was wondering, how much time does everybody want to stay here now? Because I've got this whole packet here I wanted to talk a little bit about.
You can turn to this page right here. The other thing that the kids did, if you'll turn to what it calls the Appendix B and open it out to the front, besides telling the story of the trail and having the presenters, the other thing that I wanted to do from more of a Spanish teaching languages side of things was to talk about how the trail fit into learning another language. So on the one hand, you have an illustration by Lalo Alcares and written by Ilan Stavet from the book Latino USA. And it talks about how, for example, the Rio Bravo del Norte actually had at least 78 names from 78 different languages, probably not, but definitely 78 cultural perspectives. 78 periods of history. And so, you know, that these children that I teach live in a place that is and has been constantly in flux, and that learning a language is important because it's going to help you understand your history. And then on the opposite side is what an adult does with such an idea, and this is from Aurelio Espinosa, The Folklore of Spain and the American Southwest. And it talks about how Spanish and the Pueblo Indian cultures and languages have changed one another. So, you know, you can read the article later, but I wanted you to turn that page and look at the table that Espinosa gives. And so it says, the table goes on the left-hand side, Spanish, and then it turns to Tiwa, which is spoken in Isleta, and also spoken in Taos. There's two different dialects of Tiwa. Tewa is spoken in San Juan, Queres is in Laguna, and you can go down the list and see how Spanish is interpreted in the Native American languages. Usually the words that Spanish provides these languages are things that the Spanish brought along with them and are new and need new words in the languages of the Pueblos. So for example, something like caballo
would probably have a Spanish root because the first word associated with that animal was a Spanish word because the horses arrived with the Spanish. That's the idea. And so things like iglesia, which everyone knows is church, you can see how the word misa, which is the word for mass, becomes part of the word for the place where mass takes place. And I had my kids make those connections and say, what do you see? What Spanish words do you know in these Pueblo languages? And they start seeing the relationships and how languages actually are always constantly changing. There's nothing static about a language. The dictionary is already wrong. And then Larry Torres does something much along the same lines with his handouts in his college courses. And so there's some handouts there that you can go through. This is what my fifth grade students did. And so on the one hand, we talked about Nahuatl, which is the Aztec language. One of the suffixes of Nahuatl is atl. So chocolatl becomes chocolate, which is chocolate. And then on the other side of that page, it talks about some other Aztec words that have made it into Spanish and then also into English along the way. Words like tamal, tamale, tequila was unchanged in probably every language that you can name. And so the idea that this interchange happens in languages, not just with burros and churros and blankets and things like that. And then the next page from Larry Torres is getting a little bit closer to home, where you have the Tiwa, the Spanish, and the English translation. And so in that one, you'll have to look carefully because sometimes all three languages have something in common. Sometimes Spanish and Tiwa have something in common. And sometimes all three of those words are different. And you have to think why. And that's what I asked my fifth graders to do. And it's very interesting. I mean, on that first list where you're talking about parts of the body, you should expect very little similarity. Because what is what a language does first and foremost? It names the body. So all three of those languages probably took care of that before they met one another as cultures. They knew the names of their own bodies before they met one another. But if you'll turn the page, on the other side, when you talk about, let's go all the way down to fruits and vegetables, then the fruits and the vegetables that came from Europe, you'll see that reflected in the languages. Limón is probably the most obvious example. Limón, limón, limón. On all three languages, for a good reason, because limón was the word for the tree that came from Europe, and that or from the Caribbean. Somebody correct me on that, but it was a Spanish word that did the traveling to the Southwest. Another one is naranja. Now the English is a little different. Manzana, Spanish and Tiwa are the same. So interesting stuff. And I'm not a linguist, but I think that you don't have to be to see the big idea. And then the last thing I'd like to share with you, the following pages from Espinosa, just show that not on just the level of language words, the particle, the word, but also in terms of lullabies. We all know the tales and the folk tales of the Southwest. Well, there's some examples of lullabies that were shared between the Spanish and the Puebloans. And how the words aren't the same, but the lullaby is the same. And what's more intimate than a lullaby? A mother singing to a child. And a mother recognizing, well, that's the darnest sweetest lullaby I've ever heard. I'm going to translate that and sing it to my kid, my baby. There's a certain kind of caring there. And I think we always talk about these intercultural situations as conflicts. Not if you're talking about lullabies. And I think that's an important point, is that history is always talking about clashes. And I don't think it necessarily has to be that way. And the discussion of lullabies brings that up. And finally, and I'll leave this with you. One of the things the kids did in the last page was a song called La Burrita, the little burro. Now, this song was written by Francisco Gabilondo Soler, which is, his name was Cri Cri on the radio. He broadcast in the 40s and 50s. He was a very good musician and very popular in Mexico. And many kids that grew up in Mexico and even in New Mexican Southwest know these songs because they listened to him on the radio, the Cri Cri Hour. Cri-cri is basically the cricket. So this little cricket would sing songs. And because the trail had the burros and the mules on it, this was one of the ways that I bring more people in. You get everyone involved. So I had them learn this song. I have it in translation on the other side so you can enjoy it either way. But I want to play it for you, and then we'll be done. I'll take some questions if you want to. Come up and see Luella's pottery, and sing along if you wish. So here's
Mi Burrita by Francisco Gabilondo Soler y Cricri.
Hay una burrita linda a la orilla del camino. Tiene la pezuña fina y el pelambre también fino. Como la vi tan bonita, le pedí su corazón y me dijo la burrita, no, 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 no. Y desde entonces voy suspirando y al suspirar pensando en ti, gentil burrita de los prados, la de pelitos esponjados. Seré poeta, tendré melena, haré un poema para ti, porque dijiste rebuznando, pues que no, en vez que sí. Hay una burrita hermosa por allá en los sembrados, tiene el hociquito rosa y los ojos entornados. Como la vi tan preciosa, le pedí su corazón y me contestó furiosa, no, 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 no. Ojos entornados, como la vi tan preciosa, le pedí su corazón y me contestó furiosa, no, 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 no.
So that's all I got. Any questions?
Good, I'm not going to give a quiz.
Any questions in English or Spanish?
Es bilingüe, he's bilingual.
Like a lot of you all are, and some of you aren't, but that's okay. There's always time to learn, plenty of time. Any questions? Go ahead. The little boy over there, Lord.
Yes, sir. What is your question?
I like that pretty song you just did.
Well, if I can get your email, I'll send you all of the songs.
Okay.
No, because they're on the internet and you can get them for free. All of them. So I'll show you where you can find them.
All right. I like it.
Any more questions, anyone? Ron?
Yeah, about the Antonio Armijo trip, what's it, 1829, thereabouts? In detail, accounts for the disparity in the length of the trip from going out and coming back. Was it going to unknown territory first, or without?
Well, I might open this up to the audience. There may be much more scholarly and informed people. My impression is, yeah, trial and error, and that Kenyans were a big problem. They stayed south and hit all, but not the Grand Canyon, but you know, the whole idea is that the canyons, the crossings, were incredible. It took weeks to cross a single river at times. There were huge delays. And so, and also, you know, the peoples along the way, watching them, probably decided, you know, to intervene at some point or another. I mean, that's why the Utes were so important.
Right.
It's because they acted as guides, and they kept people out of trouble after a while, and these routes became established on the basis of that advice, I'm sure, more than anything else.
Yeah, if you look at the journal, there was a scout for the expedition, Rafael Rivera, I'm sure no relationship to Lloyd. And there are several points in the journal where the expedition is camped out for several days waiting for Rafael Rivera to return with where the caravan should go. And so that may be part of the explanation why it took so much longer outgoing than returning.
Peter, Magnus, do you have any ideas concerning that question?
Probably they figured out the biggest, they were going right along the Arizona, what is now the Arizona-Utah line. And it was a trial and error experience going west. And they encountered enormous canyons, including parts of the Grand Canyon, tributaries. And it sobered them up a lot. So I think when they came back, they probably chose to go a little bit farther north, not much, but the trail was probably 100 miles south to north that they took. And like, in fact, later on, that was the last expedition that chose to go along that route. After that, everybody chose to go farther north. There were two northern routes that were much, one all the way up to Salt Lake City, almost, and then there was one that was closer to the south. But that was the most difficult. That's why they chose never to use it again. You couldn't push sheep across it, or mules or horses very easily because of their feet. They aren't rock goats. You know, goats would be fine, but they weren't running goats. And so they were looking for easy passage. And I think by the time they had made the trail people had made their next voyages in 1830, 1831, learned about the complexities of that southern route. And they knew from the Escalante, Dominguez Escalante expedition, the traps. And so they decided that the best move was from scouts and people who had done it as individuals, that the best route was farther north. And so they picked it. It wasn't, I don't know if you've ever been through that country, but a little bit north, it smooths out a little bit. It's not quite as dramatic. The canyons aren't as deep. There are more mountains, however, and that is its own set of challenges. But they found that the animals could handle the mountains and even drought better than they could handle those river crossings in those canyons, those deep canyons. Those were terrible. And they would lose a lot of animals and even people because they were dangerous. The crossings were very dangerous. And I think that they figured that out. I think that that's why the Spanish Trail is called a braided trail. And it has a variety of routes. There's no one single route. It's not like even the Oregon Trail has got a braided route. And the Pony Express Trail and the Lewis and Clark Trail, they all have braided pieces. And that's because nobody sticks to one route. It's because of the weather, which changes the route. It's the old Spanish Trail does that. The El Camino does that. The Santa Fe Trail does that. And it's because there was also an old Spanish Trail piece that went up the west side of the Rio Grande. In fact, there were several of those. And the Old Spanish Trail had both the river route that the El Camino Real had, and it also had the mountain route, which went up through places like Peñasco, starting in Chimayo. And that was because there was a lot of weavers in the towns, and the weavers, that weaving was one of the major things that they ended up as a product that they were trading. And so they wanted to pick up the weavings to take out to California, because they were extraordinarily valuable. And the mules, they could pick up, of course, they came over from Missouri, and they would pick them up over from Santa Fe to Taos. But the bridge trail syndrome prevented you from thinking in simplistic terms. You couldn't just go, oh, it's like a line on the map, and it goes boom, boom. It wasn't even the shortest distance between two points. Trails never are, because humans aren't straight. They're crooked. And the terrain is not straight. And that's why people use them the way they do. I think that the Armijo route was adventurous. The man who did that was a brilliant man, because he was the first one to push through. And after that, people said, oh, well, if he can do it, I can do it. And so you had a lot of people creating variant routes. And often the issue was water, the need for water, water for people and water for animals. Because if you went too far between watering holes, you died of starvation, lack of water. I think that answers the question.
Okay, you have all these mules going to California, right? But you bring horses back. So you get a huge caravan of, well, the mules come back again to New Mexico? No, they stay in California. Okay, so that they get the new supply of mules from...
Correct.
Back and forth, back and forth. And then once they reach back to this region, they're sold here or traded here, and then the rest are taken along the Santa Fe Trail to Missouri, and okay, as well as from Santa Fe down to Chihuahua on the Camino Real route.
But so the Santa Fe Trail too much used until really the Americans, the United States, got possession of Mexico, right? There was some trade, but it wasn't.
It, from 1821, when William Bucknell pushed it through, the first founder of the trail, and it was viable, I believe, until the railroads came through in the 1880s, in about 1880.
Yeah, my impression was that these two trails, from Independence, Missouri to Santa Fe, and Santa Fe to what became Los Angeles, were developed at the same time by different modes of technology and travel, but this was the roadway at the time, and it was the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, and then they went into disuse for different reasons. But this is contemporaneous to one another.
So is it called the Santa Fe Trail just from Missouri to Santa Fe, and then the Old Spanish Trail from Santa Fe to California, or did those two trails overlap between?
Well, the National Park Service recognizes I don't even think that the Old Spanish Trail got that name until later. I'm sure it was called Armijo's Route or the Vereda de California or something like that in Spanish, first of all. The so words we use now are what the National Park Service has chosen to name them for the purposes of preserving them.
So it's basically the same trail between Santa Fe and California?
I think that they would be two different businesses. I think you'd get to Santa Fe, mm-hmm, and then you'd let whatever happened to California and back be a different concern. I don't think you would get a bus ticket all the way to California, so to speak. You get one to Santa Fe, and that would be your concern there.
Old Santa Fe Trail.
And remember that this was the Mexican period, and this was a Spanish-speaking Mexican business, so to speak. This had very little to do with the people who lived in the America. There, in the Americas, in the United States, because where it overlapped was at Santa Fe and along the trail where what was in California made it to the East Coast, but the middlemen along the way separated those two trails from really being one trail.
People often overlook that they took the name of the Spanish Santa Fe Trail, whereas it was really a continuation onto Chihuahua, mm-hmm, along the El Camino Real, so that You could say what we call the Santa Fe Trail from Missouri went to Chihuahua through Santa Fe.
The library has a lot of excellent books pertaining to these trails. And like the Santa Fe Trail was originally called the Santa Fe Chihuahua Trail because the trade, the merchandise from Missouri, it reached Santa Fe, it reached Taos. But then from Santa Fe, it went down to Albuquerque, Socorro, Las Cruces, El Paso, across the Rio Grande to Chihuahua, even further south. That's why it was called the Santa Fe Chihuahua Trail, to encourage trade and political, social, cultural exchanges between the United States, Los Estados, and Nuevo México, and Mexico. Yes, sir, Jay?
These trails may have been established by the Native American tribes, Abiquiú guys trading with the Taos guys.
Okay, a question? Okay.
How many of these trails might have already had preliminary trails?
All of them, all these trails were already here. Because the Indians would walk, they didn't have horses or mules, you know, they would walk. These trails were already here because the Native Americans established them. And according to a lot of research that Peter has done, the paleo hunters were the first ones. Peter, could you?
Yes. The paleo hunters were following the megafauna of the Ice Age. And those animals were herd animals. And they created the trails in the mountains and along the rivers. And the hunters were following the game trails of the megafauna because they were hunting those creatures. And so they started using the trails. And when the megafauna passed, they kept the trails open. And the Indians, when they came along, used dog teams of around 50 to 100 dogs tied together. And they would pull travois. Travois are, of course, you know, forked sticks.
Poles.
Forked poles with a cross member. And you could haul a 1,000-pound load and lash it to it. And that's how they transported skins and food and everything. And so we forget often that the Indians were not always just walking. They were transporting goods with dogs, just like the people in the north, the Eskimos.
I just wanted to add that the Old Spanish Trail has, like the source is Santa Fe, through the Espanola Valley, through Taos, southern Colorado, to Los Angeles. And then the other one from Santa Fe, Espanola Valley, to Abiquiú, to Los Angeles. There's another route from Santa Fe to Espanola Valley, over here by Abiquiú, and then, before Abiquiú, it cuts off along the mesas, the plains area, toward Tres Piedras, all the way to Antonito, all the way to Alamosa. But that route, it's, according to the brochures and the studies, it's under study. It's not an official trail route yet. So anybody that's from Tres Piedras, I encourage you to join up with us and let's do some studies and let us get it established and recognized, because all of these are important. They're valuable. And if we don't do it, who's gonna do it? The BLM, the National Park Service, US Forest Service? They don't have time, man. So it has to take action from the grassroots community level, and that's one of the reasons we're doing these lectures here. And these lectures end today because the grant project ends today. And I have to submit a report on everything that has happened. All the sign-in logs will be taken. I'll be attending the national conference. And the final evaluation, I have the form here. I would like for each of you to sign one in and write down your ideas, your thoughts, your criticisms, what you'd like to see in the near future, and ideas. And let me have these forms, because this information will go to the National Trail Association as well as to the funder at San Rafael, California, because this grant project has been excellent. Great attendance, cultural diversity, Hispanos, Native American, Anglos, Danish origin, and so forth and so forth. And age range from this little tiny little girl to that little boy over there to this young lady here. And then the mid-range attendance ages. This is fantastic. This is really cool. We have Hispanos from Taos. I invited personally three or four of the leaders from the Taos Pueblo, but they never came. Well, they're busy doing all their snow shoveling and turning off fires and so forth. But I really thank you all. Anyway, so I'm going to pass these out, and I need some help here from Mr. Bird. Pass these out, fill them in, and sign them at the bottom. I just want to add one more thing that Sanders, he and I attended a workshop recently, a workshop sponsored by the Northern Rio Grande Heritage Area, and that is an organization that has already gotten funding for the next 10 years, $1 million a year. Can you imagine that? This organization has already received a grant for the next 10 years, $1 million a year, and they're going to be looking for projects to fund.